Well, a lot of people have heroes who are movie stars and rock stars. My heroes happen to be writers, and so it's an interest and concern that I have been able to take advantage of professionally for many years. And I certainly wanted to have a chance to talk to you. I was certainly moved by Affliction. It was a wonderful book. So I want to talk about Affliction and talk about you and ask you some questions that you've already been asked. There was quite an article that New York Times Magazine.
Yeah, Wesley Brown's piece.
That was great.
Yeah, I was.
That answered everything. I don't have anything to ask.
Well, we can go home then.
Yeah, go home. Go to your reading. But I'm sure there are people of the radio audience who don't know that much about you, who don't read the New York Times or can't read at all, who might be interested in an author and learning how to read and buying your books. So let's talk a bit about you, because you are basically, I guess, you are a New Englander.
Right.
So tell me about your beginnings and what made you click.
My beginnings are fairly simple. I was raised in northern New England, New Hampshire, in pretty much rural surroundings, a working-class background. My father was a plumber, grandfather's a plumber, a fairly large family, became a writer, really, by accident rather than by design, in that I found myself in my early 20s writing a lot, and that seemed to be what I was doing more than any other thing, and so I put a name on it and continued to do it. And what in terms of made me click, I guess what you mean is in terms of connect to an audience.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, the writer's the last one to know, in a sense. That's very hard to say. I know the last couple of books have managed to extend my audience. I mean, with Continental Drift and now with this book, and the book of stories, success stories in between. I mean, they're, we're talking now, I guess, after seven books. Those three have extended my audience considerably. And I think that it's a combination of factors. One is I just hung around long enough so that eventually they let me in out of the rain and said, all right, let him in. He looks sort of pathetic out there. And the other is, I think what I was doing and my particular obsessions became clearer to people, and also I think other people started consciously sharing those obsessions to a larger degree than in the 60s and 70s in particular, early 80s. So it's a lucky congruence, really, for me of various factors.
Well, I think there's another factor as well. Over a period of time, you hone your craft, you fine-tune it, you learn how to do it.
Yeah.
And I haven't read your earliest stories. Mm-hmm. But my guess is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you have a stronger and more authoritative voice now mm-hmm. than you did mm-hmm. in these tentative writing years.
I think that's true. I don't know that it's necessarily having honed my craft. In some sense, it has to do with maybe emotional maturity and growing self-confidence in the worthiness of my subject matter, and so that my approach to my subject matter became less tentative and less coy, maybe less elaborate, and I could approach the subject matter, the characters that I wanted to write about, the world that I wanted to was drawn to, in a more direct way, and that I think was brought about over a period of years through a certain amount of self-acceptance and just, I don't know what else to call it, but perhaps emotional maturity. Honing the craft is presumes in a sense that I knew what I wanted to do and was dying to do it from the start, and I don't think that's quite true.
Well, I was thinking in terms of something like this. My editor at St. Martin's Press would call me occasionally, and she would say, Don, this paragraph doesn't quite work. It needs more elaboration. Can you expand on mm-hmm. this character? I said, sure, mm-hmm. no problem. Mm-hmm. And when I was in the seventh grade, I couldn't have done it. I mean, mm-hmm. but I could do it now. It's almost mm-hmm. as though you could write on demand. And that is what I mean by honing the craft. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see, you know, the editor is right. This character mm-hmm. needs more development, and sure, I can do that. Mm-hmm. I can have more insights into that character. Mm-hmm. I can expand this paragraph. I can make it clearer.
But I really do think, though, that most of the problems of writing after a certain point of literacy come down to the problems of how you approach the subject matter, the thing written about. And that most of the difficulties a writer faces in the writing of a book or a short story or just a paragraph elaborating on a character, a description of a character, are really about your relation to the subject matter,
right.
Your relation to that character, finally. Are you willing and able to see that character more clearly and confront that character more directly? And if so, then you can elaborate that paragraph nicely.
Well, in many respects, aren't you utilizing your own origins?
Mm-hmm.
Most of your characters
mm-hmm.
are working-class, middle-class, working-class people from New Hampshire,
right.
Although many of the stories, Continental Drift, takes place in Florida, but these are still New Hampshire people who are
right,
talking
about. Right, right. And also I'm drawing, in that case, from time I spent in Florida and knowledge that I have of that area and as a young man and in the Caribbean and travels and time I spent down there, too. Oh, sure, definitely drawing on that experience. But what I mean is that I think all of us, even though we may be attempting to tell the truth, as it were, about our experiences, what we know to be true about our experiences, and turn our attention to, therefore, to our background or our past or the context we were raised in and so forth, view that through, view that very complexly. And I mean, anybody who sits down and tells you the story of their childhood, you know that that's a complicated act. That's not simply a recitation of facts. That's about that person's relation to his or her childhood, what they say. I think that's essentially true for a writer. If I'm going to write about, let's say, sex, sexual relations between, erotic relations between men and women, let's say, how I write about that, how I approach that subject matter, is determined enormously, not just by my sexual experience, but my my fears of sex, my inhibitions my unconscious relation to it, not just my history, my sexual history. It's the same thing with domestic violence. It's the same thing, I think, with writing about the economy of certain parts of the country. How you view your own past economically is a complex event. I look back on my childhood, which was basically poor, but there are a lot of people who were poor. I think of my childhood as being awful and anxiety-ridden financially. But there are other people in my family who don't find it a big problem at all.
It's interesting you say that, although you referred specifically to money. I was talking to Tobias Wolff, who wrote a memoir about his childhood. You might have read that. It was very nicely done. And he mentioned that, as far as he's concerned, the childhood, the positive elements of childhood are virtually a myth.
Mm-hmm.
That childhood, and particularly with regard to his, we had a miserable childhood, and I concur, because I'm looking back at my childhood, which didn't have the kind of problems or violence. Matter of fact, he had domestic violence in his childhood. Mm-hmm. He was beaten repeatedly by a stepfather. I never had any of that, and I had a congenial family and so forth. But I look back at my own childhood to see how many fears I was confronted with, terror, in fact, in many respects. You look at this huge world, and it's so... You can't understand it. I mean, how can you possibly learn to control it and deal with it? So childhood is an extremely difficult, awkward period for most people, but I have a feeling they don't want to admit it, because you have the Shirley Temple view of childhood.
Oh, yeah. It's your encounter with reality as a child is over and over and over again an encounter with your own powerlessness. And that is a horrifying thing to remember. Nobody wants to remember that, being that powerless. Also, I think the culture is designed in such a way as to reinforce forgetfulness rather than to remind us of it. And it's the old syndrome, too, of if you were caned as a youth, if you suffered as a child, you're likely to grow up and make other children suffer, too. You tend to repeat that, and if we're doing that, then we don't want to face the horrors of it.
I always wondered about this kid that I knew when I was growing up, named Paul Keller, who always used to beat me up, and I always wondered about him subsequently, what he's doing now, and so forth. But then I began, as I became older, began to think what his life was like that would prompt him
to
be a neighborhood bully.
I had a lucky re-encounter with the kid who beat me up. Some years ago, a magazine, New England Monthly, has a series still where they call Going Home. They sent me back to Barnstead, New Hampshire, where I went to grade school and grew up. A little two-room school. I thought I would go back to the town, and I would go to the schoolhouse, because the schoolhouse was a central place for my childhood, naturally, especially a little two-room school. They had eight grades. It was no longer functioning as a school. It was now a kind of a junk shop. The schoolyard was full of rusted out and battered old pickup trucks and cars and so forth, and stacks of doors and windows and various things. And it turned out that the guy who used to beat me up, who really did a job on me, and was now living in the schoolhouse alone, a kind of a pack rat of a man, alcoholic, my age, of course, but looking about 25 years older, a broken guy. And I told him, I have a scar in the corner of my eye, which I pointed out to him. I said, do you know how I got that? He had no memory of it. You gave me that. Mm. He was so delighted. He was absolutely thrilled.
That he accomplished
that
something.
He accomplished something. He said, I did that. It was kind of pride. I did that. I said, yeah. I stood at the end of the downside of the seesaw. He stood at the other end of the high side, and he flipped it down so that the board came up and caught me right in the corner of the eye.
Gosh, you wonder how you survived childhood.
I know.
You know, I remember one of the big fads when I was going to school, you'd be at a drinking fountain,
right,
and a kid would come behind you and push your head
right
into the fountain.
Right.
You wonder how you had teeth left.
Right.
Yeah,
I
you
know.
Wonder how you
yeah.
had teeth
I
left.
Know. I know. It's a violent world we live in.
Yeah, especially,
hits and kicks and so forth.
Childhood, childhood is a world of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really when we grow out of childhood that we learn to harness our frustrations and our violence and to behave in a socially equitable manner.
Mm-hmm.
Childhood, they don't have this feeling. They have to learn it. It has to be drummed into them because the playground is really a jungle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're only imitating what they've seen at home or on TV or anywhere else.
I don't know. Children don't understand. Mm-hmm. What's happening? I mean, they don't come into the world socially equipped, so they feel I need. Mm-hmm. They see presents.
Mm-hmm.
I want those presents for myself. Mm-hmm. They see food. They want to grab that food for themselves. Mm-hmm. Kind of like animals, and they have to be.
Oh, but educated. They come into the world wholly sentient human beings. I mean, they are. I say they as if they were another species. We.
But they are another species.
No, I don't believe
they're
that.
Not like
I don't
us.
Think so at all. I think that if we don't carry that child along inside us, then we've done something terrible to ourselves. We've destroyed that child in us out of the same kind of sentimental and nostalgic rewriting of childhood. We destroy the child unless we can allow that child. I mean, the motives are, I think, are to not allow that child to live in us, who's an utterly vulnerable and powerless and sentient human being who's so responsive to every gesture and every inflection and every mood that the parents or the adults around that person give off that that by comparison they make us look like we're made out of wood. And that's the person we want to get rid of, because that's the person that's giving us so many important and frightening messages about the world, I think. Especially men, I think, are particularly threatened by that child, that vulnerable, powerless, and extremely sensitive human being inside. That's the one we want to get rid of, I think. Forget. Don't be affected by it. If I start responding to the world the way that kid responded to the world, I'm in big trouble.
Hmm.
You know, Hamilton, I gave away the kid's name, who was my bully friend. His first name, anyhow. He was the bully because that was the he couldn't allow that sensitive, much more complex and vulnerable kid to walk around, because that kid was going to get beat up on. I mean, I was by comparison to him a much more. I was the kid he beat up on, so I was obviously more vulnerable than he, and more. even more powerless than he is, smaller, if nothing else, but less prone to violence. It's, violence scared me. It didn't scare him because it was a way of protecting himself.
Well, Affliction is very much about domestic violence, and I read in some of the publicity material that to a degree you were a victim of domestic violence in your own household. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I don't think that I'm peculiar or that that's unusual or esoteric in any way. I think that many, many, many of us are to a greater or lesser degree, if not actual physical violence, then, you know, psychic, emotional violence. Whenever one person forbids another person, denies another person's freedom and uses, you know, physical threat, the threat of physical force against them, then that's a kind of violence. I mean, I think if a man controls a woman's or a smaller person's or another person's freedom in any way by physical threat, that's violence. And I was certainly a victim of that. And my father was a violent man, and violent at home, and so I was raised with the threat of that and with the actual experience of it. As a small boy, and my mother and father were divorced when I was 12, so that removed the threat.
So you lived with your mother?
I lived with my mother through adolescence.
Did he? Yeah. Did your father drink?
Yes.
Is he still alive?
No. No, he died in 1979. It's very much associated with alcohol, usually is. It certainly is in my family's case, and is in most cases.
Well, but you mentioned...
Not in a cause-effect way, but in a complex way, more so than that.
See, I grew up in a very decent household, yet my father would use the belt on me and my brother, but I never felt, in looking back at it, that we were abused in any way. In other words, the punishment was not gratuitous. Yeah, he came from an old-fashioned family that did not believe in sparing the rod.
Were you ever frightened of him?
No, I was never frightened of him, but I was frightened of being spanked.
Yeah.
Obviously, but then I usually did something to deserve it,
yeah,
and so did my brother. So it wasn't gratuitous violence. He didn't come home and just smack us around. You know, usually it would be something like my mother saying, "You wait till your father gets home."
Right. No. So you were hit, but you were hit for a reason, which is different, I suppose, than being hit for no reason. Although no one ever says there's no reason for this. I'm just hitting you. There's always a reason given. Yeah. See, I wouldn't make a sharp distinction between what you went through and what I went through, except that it was probably much more coolly and rationally delivered. It wasn't associated with alcohol or lack of control. And there was, in your mind, and certainly in your father's mind, in mother's mind, an assumption that this is because you were bad, misbehaved, did something wrong, that you will be hit for this, physically hit for it. And then you will understand and you won't do it again. And I don't think there's a great deal of difference between that that kind of violence and the kind of violence that I endured.
Well, in Affliction, tell me a bit about Wade Whitehouse. I have the name right, don't I?
You do, yes.
Yeah, Wade Whitehouse. I often forget. I have terrible memory. Mm-hmm. I forget the names of characters, titles of books, and names of authors.
Names of authors. You're in the wrong business, aren't you?
That's terrible. People will say, "Hey, what did you read last week? I must have read five books." And I will actually have mental blocks and just absolutely forget. And I have to look at my journal to remember what I've read.
Yeah. And we don't get better at this as we get older.
No, it's scary. It's really scary. But tell me about Wade, because he was a victim of violence. He had a kind of an unusual relationship with his employer, and who really went all out to keep him and everything. So tell me a little bit about his character. What kind of person
he is? Well, I think that I view him as a man who is caught in a, I don't want to call it a syndrome, but a context of violence and a dysfunctional family, essentially. And that he was raised by a man not unlike himself. I mean, a man who was also a product of a dysfunctional family. And so he spends the period in which the book is concerned, his adult life, and the main central part of his early middle age, trying to avoid replicating his father's behavior and the tragedy of his father's life, trying to simply be a good man, a good father he wants to be to his own daughter, and a good husband. He just wants to do what good guys do. But because of the forces operating against him, which are primarily the forces that are set loose in his life in his early childhood, he's unable to do this very simple thing. He's a working class guy. He's a well driller, a part-time cop. He's the guy who escorts the kids across the street at the school crossing in the mornings. He's supposed to be the protector and custodian of the folks in the small town of Lawford, New Hampshire. And yet he seems unable to do this without coming undone. And so the book is a description, I think, of a couple of what I've tried to make it do is a description of 2 weeks in his life when he's at age 41, when all the various forces operating in his life to keep him from being a good man get confronted, I hope dramatically and suspensefully, by what seems to be a random event, an accidental shooting of a deer hunter. And that's the kind, that's sort of the point at which Wade starts to come undone. It fixes his attention. He's the town cop. He thinks he understands it and he knows how to solve it. He plugs into that role. It also is a kind of neat match for his own inner conflicts and turmoils. A younger man kills an older man. A local guy who's not unlike himself some years ago may or may not have killed an older, powerful man. And that that's a kind of objective correlative, if you will, of Wade's own inner turmoil and inner conflicts. And so the story is one that takes place over these 2 weeks of deer hunting season, while Wade confronts the mystery of who killed this particular this union leader who was deer hunting, or whether he was killed accidentally, and also attempts to regain custody of his child from his ex-wife, and also tries to, in some ways, displace his father, take over his father's house, and move in with a woman that he wants to marry and turn into his wife. He wants.
Yeah, I thought that I knew that there was going to have to be a crisis in his life, but I thought that sounded like such a terrific turning point because things hadn't gone that well, but they weren't that bad,
right.
You know. And he was able to salvage his life up to that point, and things really.
He was holding on.
Yeah, he was holding
on.
Yeah,
but he was fragile. I mean, that's the point. It opens with a fragile man, I think. You know, he drinks too much. He's alone too much. He can barely keep his little trailer he lives in clean. He gets to work on time. He takes care of business, but his relationships are coming unraveled. He gets into, you know, quarrels and even brawls at the bar late at night. And he's got a lot of rough edges that are proving problematic for him.
But in many respects, he's not unlike many, if not most people, except that, well, of course, he is unlike them in that he couldn't handle these problems. Most people limp along. So I was really rooting for him. I thought
that's good.
I thought you made him a very sympathetic character.
That's good because he's a character who's on the basis of his sociology, if nothing else, would not be somebody you would want to sit down and spend an evening with. I mean, he's a guy sliding into depression, alcoholism, and violence. He's not a well-read man. He's not articulate, really. He could be a real dreary guy on the basis of it sociologically. And he's violent. He's been violent against his wife. That's established right along. He rationalizes it, justifies it.
Of course, at the early point in the book, I thought his wife kind of deserved a clobbing. And so did I thought his daughter also. I thought his neither, I thought, was a very responsive person to
Well, it would have been... I think unrealistic, and also it would have been too easy a setup, I think, to have them have the wife be the long-suffering, patient, and dear stereotype of the victim, the battered wife victim, and the child as the poor, suffering child. I mean, they had their complex and real people full of contradictions. She's not an evil person by any means, but she's a bit of a pain in the neck, I think, as ex-wife. And the child is a child. She's conflicted and acts it out.
Of course, there's a great deal of violence at the end, but the ending, in some respects, although you tied up all the endings, or most of the endings, or most of the loose ends, I guess you'd call it, you still left yourself an option for the return of Wade Whitehouse. I have a feeling that was deliberate.
Yes. Oh, yeah, very much, yeah.
I have a feeling he went off to Detroit or someplace like that.
In Toronto, they think he went to Toronto. In Detroit, they think he went to Detroit, yeah. In Miami, they think he went to Miami.
Yeah, there's another chapter in his life that at some point you might
Yeah, he's a figure who fascinates me, and I'd like very much to stay with him. I'm not right now. I'm writing another book. I'm taking a shorter breath than this one. That's a long breath, and I tend to alternate or write a book like that or Continental Drift or the Book of Jamaica, which is longer, and then write. Usually I write short stories for a year or two afterwards to kind of recover.
Yeah, it would seem to me you're going to need some time to think about this, mull it over, you know.
Yeah.
It might take a while.
And just sort of trying to figure out what kind of monstrous thing I've done here.
Well, it's not monstrous at all. It's some of the scenes that you wrote describing the landscape, and the lay of the land in New Hampshire were really wonderful. I mean, I've never been to New Hampshire, and I could see it. That's wonderful.
That's good. I don't think the Chamber of Commerce or the State Tourist Board will be awfully happy with my view of it.
Well, you describe the reality of it, but you also described its beauty.
I hope so, yes, because it is beautiful.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the craft of writing and how one does it. How do you sit down and write a novel like Affliction? You obviously must, as we mentioned a moment ago, think about these things before you can actually sit down at your typewriter, word processor. How does a writer do it?
Well, I'm sort of a lunch bucket novelist in that I try to write every day and get up in the morning and sit down and work at it in as direct and ongoing and regular way as I can. Other writers work very differently. This is the way I can work best and get the most done. Slowly, a couple of pages a day, if I'm lucky, but regularly, slow and steady, is how I've worked over the years.
Do you plan well in advance?
No, I tend to work with a novel. I tend to work on two different planes. I tend to plan very loosely in the distance, and then very tightly in the immediate chapter or scene or two that I'm working on. I mean, I'll have two kinds of outlines that I'll work with usually. One which is a vague and general kind of look down the road that I'm free to alter. I feel loose and easy about changing and as I go. And the other is a shorter, much shorter form outline that's dealing with maybe the next 25 pages or so at a time, and working that way. I work pretty tight to that, I like to feel free to alter and as things appear. For instance, in this book, about halfway through, I realized at one point, every time I took a character out to the barn in this place, it would all go weird on me, and I couldn't get the character out. I just wanted to park the car or truck in the barn and then go back to the kitchen where the action was, where the people were, where the talking was, and the food and everything. But I couldn't get him out. He'd stand there and look out the window or something. You know how what I mean? It's a complicated thing to describe to somebody who doesn't write, but sometimes you just can't get the characters out of the room, or you can't end the conversation. And this kept happening to me. And so as it happened, I had visualized in this particular barn as my grandfather's barn, the barn behind my grandfather's house in New Hampshire. Years ago, my brother had said, "Did something terrible happen in Grandpa's barn?" And at the time, he was in therapy, and it was a serious question, and it was troubling him in dreams and so forth, and he couldn't remember anything happening. I was the older brother, so I said, "No, nothing happened in Grandpa's barn. It was terrible. We weren't supposed to play there. We used to do it, though. That was it, because it was dangerous for kids. That was all, nothing." Well, years later, here I am, every time I get near the barn, which I visualize as my grandfather's.
Wait a minute. What did happen in Grandpa's barn?
Wait. Every time I get there, it goes do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And so I called my brother, and he's out west, lives out in, at that time he's living in Arizona, and said, "You remember the barn and our conversation about that 5 years ago?" He said, "Yeah, I put it to rest. Nothing happened in Grandpa's barn." And I said, "I think something did, because I'm getting a lot of strange messages back from this image. It's resonant, and it's scary the way it's resonant." And so we talked for several hours on the phone, and several different occasions, trying to remember. And if there's such a thing as a folie à deux, there must be such a thing as a repression à deux, because we could go back together to a certain point and then we both blanked out. All we could agree was it was probably sexual, it was probably violent, and we don't know who it involved. And we felt very guilty about it. And so we obviously saw something we weren't supposed to see.
Mm.
But anyhow, this is a long way of saying I was now stuck with this barn as having great emotional resonance for me. No plot significance whatsoever. It had nothing to do with the outlines that I was working with. But I decided I'd better attend to the barn. And so I did, and started bending the shape of the book around that, and the plot, and the movement of the characters and so forth around that, until, as it turns out, it becomes a very central place. And now, as to your question, whatever did happen in Grandpa's barn, I really don't know. My brother and I don't know. At the end of it, our conversations, he said, well, thanks very much. Thanks a lot for bringing this up. You can write about it. You can go ahead and put it into a novel and invest it with all kinds of emotional significance that makes sense to you. He said, but I can't. For me, I've got to get back to the literal memory in order to understand it. But you can perhaps understand it this way. And I think that is, to some degree, what happened.
Who's your editor at Harper & Row?
Ted Solotaroff.
Now, do you work closely with him in the composition of the book?
Not really. Ted is a wonderful editor. He's the editor for the last three of my books. And he is a terrific line editor. When I've got the manuscript done and I give it to him, he goes through it line by line, word by word. And our pattern is to sit down and spend two or three days going over every single line in it. And his way of working with me is simply to raise the question, did you really mean this? Or what did you mean when you said this? Never to say you shouldn't do this, or this just doesn't work. He'll just say, what did you mean this? Is this what you want? And tell me how he responds to it. And he always asserts that, and I think he believes it too, that in the end it's my book. And he always says, it's your book, it's not my book. So I think generally he's not, I wouldn't say a hands-off editor, but he's... by any means, but he's a. Our relationship is such that I write the books and he makes me aware of every single part of them.
Well, if he spotted a major flaw, yeah. I have no doubt that he would say, "Look, this whole last section, this one third of the book, it doesn't ring true somehow." I'm sure.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, I think that he's indicated to me that there are certain parts of my work that he finds not incomprehensible necessarily, but they just simply don't move him or get to him, and my intentions and purposes are different from his, and so we let it go.
Now I see your short stories have appeared in a wide range of publications, the Missouri Review and. Esquire, don't have my glasses on, Pequod.
That's a small print in the front there, yeah.
and so forth. Yeah. How does one, there seem, outside of the New Yorker and maybe Playboy, there seems to be such a limited market. How do you sell a short story in today's society?
Well, I think there are a tremendous number of readers for short stories, and obviously a great many writers of them out there. I think if you set out to sell them, you're going to have a problem. The same as if you set out to sell poetry, you're going to have a problem. There might be two or three people who can sell poetry, but not very many, and two or three people who can sell stories, or a few magazines where you can sell stories and make enough money to live on from them, the New Yorker being the main one. After that, one or two stories a month in Esquire, or one or two stories a month in the Atlantic Monthly and so forth, or Playboy, that's it. But there is no problem publishing short stories, I think, because there are so many literary magazines, quarterlies, small magazines out there that publish short fiction that I don't think there's any problem with it. It's just a matter of a writer's approaching it from the point of view of making a living or selling $2,000 or $3,000. Getting $2,000 or $3,000 for a story, well, forget it. That's
well, incredibly, Bobby Ann Mason was telling me that the majority of her short stories to this day are rejected.
Yeah.
And she won out of every 12 stories she'll send the New Yorker is
right.
Turned down. Then she tries to send them someplace else. They're, mm-hmm. They come back. Mm-hmm. She says her advice to fledgling writers is to have a good supply of envelopes, postage stamps, yeah. and patience.
Yeah, and don't expect to make a living from it.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's like playing, you know, jazz flute or something. You know, you can, you know, do it by all means, but don't confuse that with making a living. Find another way to make a living. I mean, I that's one of the first things I try to convince my students at Princeton is that if you think this is how you're going to make your living, please think again, because you're going to have to, for years, if not for your entire career, make your living another way.
Are you teaching creative writing there?
Yes.
Yeah. What sort of class do you have? Is it a workshop?
Yeah, creative writing workshop. It's an undergraduate program. Wonderful program. Joyce Carol Oates is there, and Toni Morrison, Paul Auster, the four of us, plus a few people who come and go for a semester a year are the fiction writers, and then four or five poets there. And the classes are small, 10 students.
What are the students like? What kind of work are they doing?
Well, they're very bright. And hardworking, diligent, earnest. I think a little bit too trusting in authority and too reluctant to try anything new, to trust their dreams or to trust their fantasies or their imaginations. So we have to do a lot of encouraging in that direction. I've taught in different kinds of schools. I've taught at Sarah Lawrence, where some of the problems are the opposite. They trust their dreams without a wink, no problem, or their imaginations, as it were, but in terms of getting them to read or work hard, that's another kind of thing. The discipline of writing and working is a little bit more difficult, so you have to teach more of that and less of the other. With Princeton, you don't have to teach the value of hard work. You have to teach the value of the imagination in some ways. We've had some wonderful students come out of there. Madison Smart Bell came out of there. Jonathan Ames, a young writer, just came out of there. Pinckney Benedict just came out of there a couple of years ago. Published his first book at 23.
But it's tough, though, because I think the writer needs more discipline than almost anybody. I mean, I could come into CBS every day. I have to be here at a certain time to do a certain newscast or to meet a schedule or an appointment with you or whatever. But to go home, sometimes if I'm trying to write something, it's very seductive not to do it. I know it's something I want to do, but it's very seductive not to, because I don't really have to.
Right. I know. My father, who, as I said, was a plumber, and I was too. I was in my early 20s. I was making a living as a pipe fitter.
Well, you have something to fall back on. If the
right.
Books don't work.
I kept the tools. Right? They're in the basement. But at one point, I was he knew I was writing and was serious about it and kept at it. And so it wasn't something he particularly cared to talk about because it was somehow suspicious nighttime activity. He didn't want to get into it too deeply. But he said, okay, why are you doing this? I said, well, you know, because I want to. He said, nobody makes you do it, right? I said, right. He said, you don't, you know, on Saturdays and Sundays when you're home, you know, nobody says get up. You have to turn it in by a certain date or anything. I said, right, just do it. He just looked at me the longest time, and he says, I don't get it. He really didn't get it.
Well, to end our conversation, I'll tell you a little story about my father. After I graduated from college, I landed a job as a radio announcer working the all-night shift. I came in at 12 midnight. My father was a very conservative businessman. But I was delighted. I had this brand-new job working the... I always wanted to be an all-night disc jockey, even though it wasn't...
Sounds like madness to me.
Right. Well, even though it was in Huntington, West Virginia. And so I was delighted, and I told my father I'd landed this great job... I went in at midnight and worked all night. My father said, you know, there's something unnatural about that.
Something unnatural.
Yeah, he just didn't get it. Yeah, he just didn't get it.
Well, it's like, but what it means is, he didn't get love. He didn't get, my father didn't get, and that was, love is unnatural. Because that's all you're doing. You're doing what you love to do. And that's a hard thing for most working people to understand, that there is a possibility of loving what you're doing. I love to write.
And I still often come in at midnight to work, and I work weekends and holidays and things like that. It's something that goes with the business.
Right. And most people's relation to work, unfortunately, is not a love relation by any means. So those of us who have such a relation to work are perplexing and bewildering.
Well, I'm ready to get a divorce, actually. I had some management, some consultants in who gave us a seminar, which unfortunately... or fortunately, in my case, I missed. I was on vacation, but they wanted to motivate everybody to rally around the flag, mm-hmm. work for democracy, be a team, and this sort of thing.
Sounds like you're ready for your own radio station.
That's what these consultants were urging our staff, you know, in a series of seminars. Fortunately, I missed that. Mm-hmm. Well, Russell Banks, Affliction's a terrific book. You're
Thank you.
A wonderful writer. I'm certainly going to look forward to reading your next piece of work. I thank you very, very much.
Thank you.